Okay, so just a quick preface to everything. So there's a number of different algorithms described in these notes for doing linear algebra, and I talked a lot about them, about some of them on Monday. One hole that I need to fill in, which I think I explained badly, or which was really annoying on Monday, was this issue of how to reduce inverting a matrix to matrix multiplication. And I'm just going to make literally two very quick remarks that will make it so that you can always remember how to do this, and you can certainly make it, if Cooper were here, he can make it as an exercise for his class. But you have a big matrix M. And by the way, I wrote this all down as algorithm, it's algorithm 7.4.1. So basically it starts on the upper right part of this second page of the first piece of paper. First piece of paper, upper right, that section, section 7.4. And then these don't go left to right, it goes top to bottom. I know, it's annoying. So it goes page 703, and then page 704 is right below it. Page 103, and then page 104 is right below it. Okay, so you have a matrix M, and let's just suppose that you write it as a block direct sum of smaller matrices, where each is half the size of M. And we could assume, since we're going to invert M, that M has size 2 to the N by 2 to the N. That's an easy assumption to make. You simply pad a whole bunch of 1s on the lower right, and you'll get a 2 to the N by 2 to the N matrix, whose inverse easily gives you back the inverse of M. Now, here's the trick. Just view this as a 2 by 2 matrix over the integers. Put the identity matrix over here. And now do the standard algorithm for computing the inverse of a matrix that you learn in any linear algebra class. Namely, multiply through the first row by A inverse to get I A inverse B A inverse 0 and then C D 0 I. And then you just continue doing this. You add minus C times the first row to the second row, and after a couple of steps, you'll have the identity matrix on the left and the inverse of your original matrix on the right. And if you look on page 104, the lower right corner of the first piece of paper, then you'll see explicitly how this works. So at the end, you end up with such a matrix. I've written it in terms of some other letters, just so it's a little bit easier. But at the end, you end up with a matrix that you can compute completely explicitly, just in terms of matrix multiplications and additions, and it gives you the inverse of the matrix you started with. Okay? So that fills in the hole that I neglected to explain last time. And that's it. Okay, so that's one issue. And I've written up the details of finding the inverse. Another issue is what to do if, for example, you could have an invertible matrix here. Here's an example of such a matrix, 0, I, I, 0. What if, here the A isn't invertible, so you can't do the first step. So in your linear algebra class, I guess what you would do, that's better than what I did here. In linear algebra class, you'd swap these two, and then you would invert that one. Does one or the other of these have to be invertible? Probably not. I have to think about that. I don't think either of these has to be invertible. Because, for example, I have to think about that. So in the notes, I describe a way that doesn't require invertibility with either one.
Yeah, I don't think either one has to
be. Yeah, so I don't assume.
Some kind of identity split.
Yeah. So either one needs to be invertible. So you can't just directly do what you do in a linear algebra class, which is just to swap the two and then make the one that's invertible on the top. Because neither, it might be the case that neither is invertible. So what you can do instead is apply a random permutation to the rows of your original matrix. And there'll be some permutation for which the upper left corner is invertible. And if you apply a random permutation to the rows of M, carry out this algorithm, and then apply exactly that permutation to the columns of the result, then you'll end up with the inverse of M. Okay? And let's see. So I technically should argue that there's some permutation of the rows so that the upper left matrix is invertible. Do I need to argue that? Okay. Actually, I do. Any thoughts? I haven't thought about that. Why is there some permutation of the rows so the upper left matrix is invertible? If you start with an invertible matrix, think about it.
First n columns
are linearly independent. So. That's true. And the first n rows are also the first n columns are linearly independent. So they're
find a minor.
Yeah, exactly. The linear relations between the columns are preserved via permuting the rows, and there's no linear relation between the columns.
Actually, you did say column eliminations. If take looking on the side, the pivot rows would give us what we would be what we needed.
Right. That's right. Okay, good. So I like that argument. So you have this invertible matrix. You take the first half of the matrix, and then you do column elimination by multiplying on the right. In other words, you compute the reduced row echelon form of the transpose of the first half matrix, and the pivots of that transpose matrix exactly give you rows that are linearly independent. So there exists at least some collection of rows that are linearly independent. One thing to think about is if you take a random permutation, what's the probability that you're going to select linearly independent rows? If your matrix is randomly distributed in some sense. And I haven't thought about that at all, but I'm not going to for the moment either. Okay, so, and by the way, if you're really worried about that, you could take your matrix, reduce it modulo a single prime, and then just do the echelon directly, which is pretty cheap if you're working modulo a single small prime. Something that you probably don't have a sense for if you haven't done a lot of implementation of algorithms is that doing arithmetic mod a prime p, where p is at most 2 to the power 32 or 2 to the power 64, is vastly easier than doing arithmetic modulo a prime p, where maybe p has 100 digits or 1,000 digits. It's just hugely, hugely easier. Computers can very, very quickly do an arithmetic operation mod p, but they can't quickly do an arithmetic operation when p is small, and they can't do one mod p when p is huge. Also, anything like echelon form, you have huge numbers during the intermediate steps, even though at the end they tend to settle down. Okay, so that was one thing to point out, and just to clean up from last time. What else did I want to clean up? Okay, so another point, and this is kind of a change in perspective, linear algebra. So the linear algebra problems that people, I guess, do, especially in a linear algebra class, are usually with fairly small matrices, and then standard algorithms work pretty well. But the linear algebra problems you do if you're studying modular forms, the matrices can easily have size 500 by 500 or 1,000 by 1,000. And there, if you don't take advantage of some asymptotically fast algorithm, things go really, really badly. And as far as I know, there's only one computer program that has a systematic implementation of asymptotically fast algorithms for working with matrices over exact rings, and that's Magma. And the person that implemented all of it was Alan Stevens. I poked over and over again that he would write an article or a book that describes how this stuff works. And I've cornered him a few times and got some idea, but he hasn't done so. And there isn't, so I don't know what the situation is with the latest versions of Maple and Mathematica, but they're even more close than Magma, so it doesn't really matter. But certainly if you look at Paris or Gap or whatever, their linear algebra is really pitiful compared to Magma's. Magma is shocking, 100 times faster in a lot of cases. You just take a random 500 by 500 or 500 by 1,000 matrix of the rationals, Magma can pretty easily deal with it. The memory, it'll use a lot of memory, but it'll deal with it. Whereas the other systems often just completely take forever. And the reason that Magma can do much better than the other systems is because systematically throughout everything, there's an implementation of asymptotically fast algorithms. So these are algorithms that are just way, they really, really take advantage of the fact you can multiply matrices quickly, or more quickly than O, than you can do Gauss elimination. Also, there's a Hermite normal form algorithm in Magma. So you might not care about Hermite normal form. It's simply the analog of echelon form, but over the integers. And it's the absolutely most important basic algorithm if you want to do anything with Z modules instead of vector spaces. For example, if you want to systematically set up a program that can compute with integral homology or almost equivalently with torsion points on modular abelian varieties. And I wrote something like that. To make it fast, to make it fast, you have to have a really, really fast Hermite normal form. Otherwise, the whole thing is just really slow. Perry has an okay, seems really impressive if you try to implement your own, but Perry's Hermite normal form compared to Magma's is really pitiful. Magma's is incredibly fast. If you look at, and I don't know anywhere that what Magma's does is written down, but if you look at the very last page of the handout, it's at the end of Alan Steele's description of his Hermite normal form algorithm. You'll find some timings that he gives. And basically has the size of the matrix you're computing the Hermite normal form of. And then it has sort of how long the first column after the dimension, that's how long pretty much the standard algorithm takes, anything but his, basically. So for example, for a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, it's 55,000 seconds. For his much more clever asymptotically fast algorithm, it's 246 seconds. So he gets vastly faster timings using asymptotically fast algorithms when the matrices get big. And it's also smaller when, or faster when the matrices are small. But it's really shockingly good. So there are a whole bunch of these asymptotically fast algorithms that I guess Alan basically worked out himself and stuck in Magma and optimized a lot and didn't. He describes how good they are in this talk, but he doesn't tell you how really any of them work, which is pretty annoying. And maybe a good student project would be to help me reverse engineer some of these. I've been trying to do that in the notes, but it's pretty tricky. These are things he spent years on, and he keeps them in Magma and won't publish. So anyways, really the picture is this. So whenever you have linear algebra over Q, one of the possible ways you can approach it is just do all your arithmetic over Q using the standard Gauss elimination. That's the most naive way. And that's what you'll find in a lot of programs. If you Gauss elimination, you try to make the arithmetic over Q very, very fast using good algorithms for doing addition and multiplication in the rationals of the integers. You can get pretty far this way, but you run into a lot of problems. If you want to do something really big. Another way is all these multi-modular algorithms. These seem extremely attractive at first glance. The multi-modular algorithms, there's a whole class of them. There are tons of different multi-modular algorithms. I explained one of them to you on Monday, which is you want to compute an echelon form. You take your matrix, reduce it modulo a whole bunch of primes, compute the echelon forms there, use Chinese remainder theorem and rational reconstruction, and you get back the echelon form of your original matrix. There are a couple of subtleties involving knowing when you're done and so on, but they can all be addressed very nicely. And these are nice in that you're very excited because if you look at, if you have a 500 by 500 matrix, say, and you try to compute the echelon form out of prime p, you can really optimize that. And it goes very quickly, like hundreds, way, way, way faster than taking that exact same matrix over q and computing its echelon form directly over q. The annoying part, though, is you end up having to do this echelon form mod p for a huge number of different primes p. And then reassembling the result and lifting it, that also takes a while. So the annoying thing is you have so many different primes p that you have to work modulo. And then the third method is, and here you don't take advantage at all, really, of asymptotically fast matrix multiplication. Yes?
How do you determine the number of primes to use?
Okay, so you can make, if you have some idea of what the answer will look like, then you can come up with a good guess for how many primes to use, then you can try that many, and then you can either prove that you got the right answer or have to use more primes. And in practice, for a given application, you can have a sense of how big the answer is likely to be. For example, if you're in a modular symbols presentation calculation, usually the answer has very small entries in it. And so you just, you know, you have to use enough primes. Basically, the number of primes is a function of the size of the matrix, the size of the largest entry of the matrix, and then some additional guess that involves how big you think the answer will be. So I think basically you just add together the height of those three things, and that tells you how many primes.
So what do you do you usually start with a like a long list of primes and then just do it and then see if it works, or
yes.
You try it by like 10 and then
in order to provably get the right answer, you need at least that the product of the primes is bigger than any entry in this matrix multiplied by the number of rows or columns of the matrix.
Oh, okay.
So you need, there's a minimum number that you need.
Okay.
For a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, that minimum number would be pretty big already. But not too big, actually. Depends, if your matrix that you start with has very small entries, and you think the answer will also have small entries, then you can use a small number of primes and provably get the right answer. So in some cases, this is really good. But in general, especially for dense matrices, it's horrible. And this is where really, really bad. This is bad. And then there's these asymptotically fast methods. So I'll say fast methods that try to leverage the fact that for matrices that are large, you can do matrix multiplication quickly. And there are a number of ways in which you can try to leverage that fact. Actually, here's a really clever one that you might never imagine somebody would think of, but it works really well. So. Though it's not, as far as I know, it's not used in magma, but you could use it to do some really amazing things. So numerical analysts have these, they work really hard to optimize matrix multiplication on specific machines, even to make, if you have a parallel machine, they optimize it and so on. So I'm not talking about matrix multiplication over the rationals or the integers, they optimize matrix multiplication with floating point numbers. So that is like a decimal number with a finite amount of precision. And a really cool idea is the following. Say you have a matrix over the integers and another matrix over the integers, and you want to multiply the two together, but somehow leverage the fact that these applied mathematicians and numerical analysts have made matrix multiply code for floating point numbers that's incredibly fast. Like, you know, if you use MATLAB or something, you'll find that it can do matrix operations over with floating point numbers, you know, 1,000 by 1,000, 2,000 by 2,000 matrices pretty surprisingly quickly. And moreover, it's not just that there happen to be people that like doing these floating point operations. The companies that build computers specifically design their architectures to be better at this because it's useful in video games and numerical simulations and so on. So it's just, you know, realize that the real world is that way. So here's the trick, which I learned from a paper of four French mathematicians. Actually, I read the abstract and then I had to go meet my wife, so I didn't get to read the method, which was really frustrating. So I invented it myself, just walking to meet my wife. That tells you how easy it is. So it's not a very clever thing. But what I invented was identical to what they had. So you have your big matrix over the integers, you have another big matrix over the integers, and you want to multiply these two. And the magic thing you have at your disposal is that you can multiply matrices with floating point entries shockingly quickly. Okay? So here's the trick. First thing, I'm assuming these are over the integers. The first thing you do is note that you can do it modulo, you can do this multiplication modulo a whole bunch of primes and then get the answer using Chinese remainder theorem. So if, as long as you can at least do the multiplication spot each of the primes pretty quickly, you'll be in good shape. So that reduces the question to doing the multiplication of two matrices mod p quickly. Okay? Now still, doing it mod a single prime p, how can you use floating point numbers at all? But if you make, here's what you do. So first you break up your matrix into smaller matrices, and then use Strassen's method to write this as matrix multiplies of the smaller matrices. By the way, the exact statement of Strassen's theorem is in Alan Steele's very nice notes that I handed out. And you'll find it, if you go to basically the third piece of paper, right at the beginning, here is Strawson's method. And it gives completely explicitly the 7 rather than 8 multiplications that you do in order to multiply 2 matrices, just in case you're curious. So he starts out with, on page, in the upper right corner, he starts out with 2 matrices, and he writes down, if you go down a little, he writes down 7 numbers, x1 through x7, and then he writes down the entries of the product of the 2 matrices in terms of x1 through x7. And the, you think it wouldn't matter very much, but the total number of dots is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Wait a minute. But there's some clever way to do it using... Oh, no, sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... Yeah, there's 7 dots, because there's 1 dot for each of the x's. So you have 7 dots instead of 8, and that makes a huge difference, because the additions don't matter. Adding 2 matrices is, easy. O of n squared. Multiplying is O of n cubed, or better. So in any case... you break up these matrices, you write down all of these other matrices, and now you haven't really got any more, have you? Because now again you have a matrix over z mod pz, and say another one over here, and you have to multiply those together. However, if you do this, if these matrices are really, really big, 1,000 by 1,000, okay, well, you just keep breaking them up. But at some point, they're going to get pretty small, say at most 100 by 100. And then you're reduced to the question of how do you multiply 2 100 by 100 matrices over z mod pz? Okay, so now we're assuming that they're both 100 by 100. And now you can use your floating point numerical analysts package. Because you just think of each of these numbers mod p as floating point numbers, and you make sure that you write them as numbers between 0 and 99. I'm sorry, 0 and p minus 1. So you write them all as numbers between 0 and p minus 1. And all you have to do is make sure that 100 times p is less than basically some power of 2. Say, maybe, I don't know what it would be, maybe 2 to the 31, depends on your computer. Something like that. So there's some specific bound, so that for any floating point number up to that bound, you won't overflow. So what happens is you just feed these 2 matrices into the floating point matrix multiply routine. And what it does is, when it does the matrix multiplications, actually, I'm going to use this square, you're right. You do them, you just view these numbers between 0 and p minus 1 as exact, as floating point numbers. You have a number between 0 and p minus 1 times a number between 0 and p minus 1. The product will be at most p minus 1 squared. And when you add up to compute the upper left entry, the resulting number will be at most 100 times the biggest possibility for each entry. So each of these floating point numbers that you get will be so small that even when you multiply these 2 matrices together, you can see what you can take the resulting floating point numbers and just reduce them log p, and you'll end up with the answer. Okay. But the thing to keep in mind is that you choose this 100, maybe it's not really 100, but you choose it to be optimal, and then you're only going to do maybe 50 or 60 of these, but they're incredibly quick, and then you just have some overhead that's incurred in putting everything back together. But does that make sense? It's really, really simple. But the idea is a combination of things. One, you can do this multiply blindingly quickly. 2, this multiply loses no information at all as long as you do it at the point at which, when in Strawson, your matrices got small enough that you don't overflow the floating point numbers. Okay? Does anybody not completely understand that? Does anybody completely understand it? Does anybody understand it at all?
I'm sorry, sir.
Yes, please.
I actually wasn't listening to
this. Sure.
What's the quick multiplication there?
It's just a fact of life that matrices with floating point entries are optimized on computer hardware to be multiplied.
But how are you using this?
How am I using that?
Easy, yeah.
So you have two matrices mod P and you want to multiply them. So you just take the entries of the matrices, view them as floating point numbers, and then do the matrix multiply with these floating point matrices. And then the result is a floating point matrix, a matrix that floats in it. But you can recognize what entries of Z mod PZ those floats correspond to, because you have an overflow.
Oh.
I mean, a really, really simple instance of this is if you have two integers mod P and you want to multiply them, you might view them as, say, doubles or floats, multiply those. And then as long as they're not too big, you could then make them back into integers and reduce those modulo P. And in some computers, multiplying a double can be faster than multiplying an int. Or multiplying a float can be faster than multiplying an int. So you end up winning more in the end. Does that make sense to everyone? So it's just a trick that takes advantage of how actual computer hardware is. Which, in actual computer hardware, this sort of thing can be shockingly fast compared to anything you can implement no matter how hard you try with ints. Because there's special purpose hardware designed exactly to do this. So that's kind of an amusing aside, but in any case, matrix multiplication, because of things like this, and just because of the nature of matrix multiplication, when the matrices get big, asymptotically, matrix multiplication-based algorithms are faster than anything else, namely directly working, or even working mod a bunch of times. And I mean, the timings are made incredibly clear in Alan Steele's paper. In fact, I think he even got some money from Knuth for it. So Knuth said, open problem, convince me that asymptotically fast methods are of practical value. And then Alan, I guess, got a check from Knuth because he did indeed do so. Okay, so Knuth wrote these books, Art of Computer Science. Okay, so there are lots of examples in here. So let's see, another thing that I wrote up in here.
This is the second result, so he's on
what?
That much. What's the 2.6 mean?
Sorry, which page are you looking at?
Oh, the time is down.
The very end?
Yeah.
They're in seconds.
Okay.
Yeah, in all cases, they're in seconds. Okay, another thing I wrote up here, algorithm 742 on the second piece of paper is an algorithm for computing echelon forms quickly using matrix multiplication. So I alluded to this yesterday on Monday, but I probably gave the appearance that I didn't know exactly how to actually carry it out. And that's because I actually didn't know how to carry it out. If you look at Alan Steele's notes, he says there exists a method, I've implemented it in Magma, and it was really, really hard. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, basically. So I think I came up with a method as well. It seems to be different than what he does. So he says this, he has a whole section called Recursive Echelonization Algorithm, and he says, this is on page 14 of what he does, it says that there's a similar idea to deal with more general matrices, but there are a whole bunch of issues involving nasty cases, ranks of submatrices not equaling numbers of rows, whatever that means, pivot columns, and second recursive echelon. It sounds very complicated, whatever he's doing, but he doesn't say what he's actually doing. So I wrote down what I think is an algorithm using matrix multiplication to compute echelon forms on page 105, but it's sort of a hybrid. What it does is you reduce modulo 1 prime. This is on page 105 of what I wrote. Reduce modulo 1 prime. You get the reduced row echelon form mod that prime, and you do that just using Gauss elimination, which modulo small prime is pretty fast, is quite fast. Though some could argue that you should use, well, I'm not sure, I don't know. It seems like you have to do something very complicated to avoid this first step. I don't quite know how to do that. I don't know how to do that, and that's, I think, what he's doing here. In any case, you have a matrix over the rationals, you want to compute its echelon form, so you reduce it modulo a prime, you compute the echelon form of that. Then, using that echelon form, you extract out a submatrix that's invertible of your original matrix. You invert that matrix using fast inversion, and then you multiply through using that inverted matrix, and you get something that gives you either the reduced row echelon form or it doesn't. And if it either gives you the reduced row echelon form and or it gives you sort of a top piece of the reduced row echelon form. And you can determine which by doing one additional matrix multiplication. You can determine whether or not your process worked. The process will fail if the prime p is a prime for which the rank of the matrix goes down mod p. So you have to watch out for that. But I came up with a way of detecting this. I haven't implemented this yet, and I'd love to do so. And I'm sure there's a project in this, or a number of projects in this chapter for people to work on besides me. But it would be neat if there could finally be some open source implementation of this sort of thing. Okay, so I won't say more about the details of that. And I think I'm gonna tell you about yet another very, very relevant algorithm that I think it's from the 80s. And it's really cool. So wouldn't it be neat if you, so this, we're just gonna change here, so I'll pause for 10 seconds. Okay. So another problem besides echelon form, and this kind of goes back to actually a remark Ralph made at the end of my lecture on Monday, which is, are there ways to get directly at the null space of a matrix without computing an echelon form at all? Or maybe doing a little bit of echelon form calculation, but not doing the whole thing over the rational numbers. And I'll describe a method that is hinted at in Alan Steele's notes here called p-adic method. And there are some steps missing in it here, and there are some other steps in other places. So I put them all together, and I think I have a p-adic method for computing null spaces. In the notes, this is the very last algorithm in the chapter I wrote. So it's at the very end there. It's called p-adic null space. Actually, it's the second to last algorithm, p-adic null space. So this is pretty clever. What you do is you have your matrix with, say, integer entries or rational entries where the entries are coprimed to p, to a prime p. And what you do is you find an element of the kernel of the matrix mod p, and then you use something that's kind of like a Newton iteration to construct up an approximate p-adic solution to a, to or p-adic, you p-adically construct a vector that's in the kernel of the matrix. Okay, by some successive approximations, which all involve solving an equation mod p. It's really cool. And what you do is you construct a vector v that is a solution mod p to the n for some n to the equation a v equal to 0. Then, once you have such a thing, you can view it as, well, you can think of its elements as numbers mod p to the n. Use rational reconstruction to find a vector over the rationals that reduces to the same thing as v, modulo p to the n. And then with some luck, that will in fact be in the kernel of a. So I'll call this v prime, and you get this using rational reconstruction. On this. So you do use rational reconstruction, and if you want, you can verify in this time Oven squared that this was a valid vector in the kernel. Okay, so now let me tell you how it works. And I've always found this confusing to derive myself from scratch. So I'll try to be very, very careful about this. So, but it's really, really neat. Basically, you can solve, I'm going to explain how you can solve a linear system over Q, or you can find elements in the null space. This, you can also reword this as an algorithm to solve a linear system over Q, entirely by solving a linear system, appropriate sequence of linear systems mod P. Every time, you work entirely mod P. Okay? So is what I'm going to tell you clear? Good. Now, here's what you do. So, I'll be very careful and just follow the steps of the algorithm. So the input is, for simplicity, a matrix A with integer entries. But since you're going to find something that's null space, you know, rational entries clearing the denominators wouldn't hurt. So it doesn't change the null space. That's the input, and the output is a
exactly one vector in the kernel of the matrix. Vector called Z, actually, in kernel of A, with Z not equal to 0 if kernel of A is non-zero. And so that's what this does. It's a randomized algorithm, so you could run it a number of times and it would give you the entire kernel. So you could generate up the kernel. Okay? And as Ralph pointed out last time, if you can write down a basis for the kernel of a matrix, you can also write down its echelon form.
Okay, so here's what you do.
And this is the last thing I'm going to explain today. First step is you choose a prime P. And you do it at random. The prime that you choose will depend on the capabilities of your computer and things you've implemented. That's just, you know, if you have a 64-bit computer, you might choose a bigger prime than if you have a 32-bit computer, for example. So you choose a prime key, then you compute the echelon form of A mod P. And you can do this via any algorithm for computing echelon forms. The echelon form is unique, so you just get something. But one way, since you're working modulo a fairly small prime, computing the echelon form, even using just standard Gauss elimination, probably isn't going to be very bad. There's no blow-up. Each arithmetic operation is the same amount of time as any other. So, pretty good. Alan Steele says in here that you should use some asymptotically fast matrix multiply-based thing for computing this echelon form. And I don't know how to do that, so I'm not going to say you have to do that here. I simply don't see how to do it. Okay, step three. After you've computed the echelon form, you find something in the kernel. Oh, by the way, when you compute the echelon form, if it turns out that this A has full rank, so the kernel is zero, then you know that, I mean, if it turns out that A mod P has full rank, then A has full rank, and you say kernel of A is zero, and you're done. So now we may assume that A doesn't have full rank, so we can immediately just write down, as I mentioned right at the beginning on Monday, or sorry, on Wednesday, same as I knew Wednesday, write down a D with, oh, actually I'm going to use a notation whose meaning will be clear in a minute. Write down Y0 with A Y0 equal to 0 mod P. Okay, so that's something you can just immediately do. And you get that, you can just read it off from the echelon form. Okay, so it seems like the natural thing to do, you want to solve a system, AV equals 0, so you try to solve it mod P, and that's a solution. Now, how can we somehow get from this approach a solution over the PX to some very high precision? And that's what I'll explain now. So you set up a little notation, let B0 be the 0 vector. By the way, all these vectors that I write down, you should think of them as having integer entries. And it's just that you find one that satisfies this equation. You could think of doing the arithmetic mod P and then viewing the numbers as numbers between 0 and P minus 1, for example. Okay, set P0 to be 0. And for each M equals 0, 1, 2. Basically, I'm going to tell you how to extend what we just did. 3, and so on, up to some stopping point, which I'll just call K, somewhat arbitrarily. Do the following. Solve or find y sub m, kind of like this, such that a y sub m is equal to b sub m modulo p. Remember, I promised you only have to solve equations mod p, and b sub 0 is 0. So the first step here is just exactly what I already mentioned doing. And now here's how you define the rest of the B sub m's. B sub m is
B sub m plus 1 is equal to B sub m minus a times y sub m divided by p. And notice that y sub m is a solution. It's an integer vector which satisfies a y m is congruent to b m mod p. Therefore, the difference is divisible by p. So this makes sense. And b m plus 1 is an integer vector as well. Now, here's the neat thing. Then, x, which is equal to y0 plus y1 times p plus y2 p squared plus dot 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 all the way up to yk p to the k. This is a solution mod p to the k plus 1. In other words, what we're doing here is we're computing the p-adic digits of a solution. Okay? And now I'm going to convince you that this is right, that this last statement is right. So it's certainly true when k is equal to 1, because all this is same. So maybe I should write out the same. Then x is a solution to ax equals 0 mod p to the power of k plus 1.
Is that the exact same proof on the proof of those lemmas?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, literally, all I'm going to do is simply, basically, I'm just going to plug it in and see that it works. So.
But in the process of searching for that, that's basically what you do.
Probably, yes. I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't thought about it.
I strongly encourage you to.
Okay, so now, it's certainly true if k equals 0, because then x is just y0, you didn't even define a y1, and y0 was, by definition, a solution mod p. So you'll probably feel convinced if I just show you one more step. So if you repeat this procedure and define y1 to be a solution to ay1 is congruent to b1 mod p, then let's see what where remember we've got to define b1. B1 is equal to b0, which is the zero vector, minus a y0 over p. Okay, and because b0 is the zero vector, which by the way this algorithm is worth finding if it wasn't the zero vector, and we get a way to approximate a solution to ax equals b0. But so b1 equal to this. This has integer entries because y0 is a solution to, is a null vector mod p. It's an element of the null space mod p. And now solve this. I think it's conceivable that this wouldn't have a solution. And that would only happen if a had smaller rank mod p than it has in characteristic 0. I mean, you could take here's a really bad example. Take the identity matrix times p. If you reduce it modulo p, you get the 0 matrix. And any vector is a solution to ax equal to 0. But then when you try to iterate this process, you'll quickly find that you can't find any solutions. So that's an issue. But if at some point you don't find a solution, it's because you worked modulo the wrong prime, so you simply stop and you try a different prime. Okay? And for all the finitely many primes, this procedure will work, because the only primes you have to avoid are the ones that, it's just for all the finitely many primes this works. Okay, so now let me convince you that this y1 is a solution mod p squared. That just by solving an equation mod p, we've successfully found a solution mod p squared. And by the way, as far as solving this goes, well, you have A modulo P in reduced row echelon form. So you can just read off a solution sort of by back substitution. So, you know, if you have your matrix in reduced row echelon form and you want to write this B1 really as a linear combination of the columns of
Well, I mean, that's a standard thing, but.
Nice to remember the rows. It's definitely a
straightforward thing to do.
It's order.
Yeah, it's order
n anyway.
Yeah. Yes, it's order n anyway. It might be better to compute the reduced column by the column echelon form. You could do either. All you need is something so that you can quickly solve the equation. I'm not going to worry about that, so it's really not relevant. The point is you're solving only an equation mod p, and via some pre-calculation with a, you can set yourself up so that it's easy to solve repeatedly an equation mod p. You don't have to work mod p squared at all. So let's just verify that let's verify that y0 plus p times y1, or maybe I'll put the order correctly, y1 times p, let's verify that this is 0 mod p squared. Okay, so let's do it. So this is equal to a y0 plus a y1p. And right here, AY1 is B1 mod P, but B1 is minus A over Y0, minus AY0 over P. So let me just write that in here. Minus AY0 over P. If you multiply both sides of this congruence of vectors of integers mod P, you'll get, by P, you'll get a congruence mod P squared. So these are vectors of integers. This is congruent mod P squared. 2, what I get if I multiply both sides, I get that PAY1 is congruent to minus AY0 mod P squared, but that's just 0. So you see that, in fact, Y0 plus Y1P is a solution mod P squared, or a null space vector mod P squared. And if you iterate this, you do the same thing again and again, each time you're solving a system only mod p, but when you do it multiple times, you obtain a solution mod of big power of p, which is kind of neat. Okay, and I'm done. But just the finish is that if you look through Alan Steele's nice notes, you'll find that he describes really a whole new perspective on linear algebra over exact rings than you find implemented even today in most systems, and I really wish all of this were sort of out in the open as much as possible. So hopefully somebody will help me out with this. There's a lot of stuff that's not so obvious how you do it, and he just says, I figured it out and it was really hard.